Hello, everyone, and welcome to Heard on the Street, Street Fights podcast, where we uncover the stories behind the companies, and more importantly, the people that constitute this sector of media and advertising that we all call local. So where are they from? What makes them tick? What business and life lessons can we draw from that? So I'm Mike Boland, lead analyst at Street Fight, and our guest today is Charlene Lee, longtime industry analyst, thought leader, and four-time book author. So we talked to Charlene from our studio in San Francisco about the key trends she's tracking and the strategic insights that she has to share. So here's our discussion with Charlene. So Charlene, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So we have a lot to talk about, including diving deeper into some of the things I just mentioned. But first, for those unfamiliar, let's start with a quick intro for you and for Altimeter.
Sure. Again, my name is Charlene Lee. I'm the founder of Altimeter, which I founded back in 2008. And we're an analyst firm, a very disruptive analyst firm. I was at Forrester for almost 10 years and left after my first book. Started Altimeter with a few other partners, and then grew it in the midst of the recession. Actually, it was a great time to start an analyst firm in retrospect. And then in 2015, sold it to a company called Prophet, P-R-O-P-H-E-T, where I've been happily, again, running Altimeter and being an analyst there.
Yeah, and there's a lot there that we have to dive into, and I'm excited to do so as a fellow member of the analyst corps. For those of you listening, we gave each other the secret handshake before the episode. Let's, as we like to do on this show, before kind of talking about the present, we hit the rewind button, go back to the beginning of your career, and talk about the path that kind of brought you into all of this. So how did you first get into kind of the world of tech and media and the analyst corps?
Well, I went into tech right out of Harvard Business School, and I actually went into newspapers, but I joined the San Jose Mercury News in 1993 in the middle of Silicon Valley because I believed the internet was going to come. And by the way, I graduated before the World Wide Web was invented.
Yep.
So this is a long time ago, but I believed in what the future would have, and I made a bet that newspapers would be one of the first industries impacted. So I had a front row seat to the internet being born through the World Wide Web and the whole phenomenon there. Worked in newspapers for 5 years, had some kids, and decided I didn't want to manage people anymore. I wanted to just be an analyst, be an individual contributor. So I thought I would be at Forrester for maybe 2 years because I love the research. I've always loved doing that kind of work. And I stayed. I just kept staying because I found that I was really good at it. I enjoyed it. And it gave me this incredible way to make the trade-offs that you need to as a working parent to make everything work. So it was just the right place and right time for what I wanted to do with my career.
That's great. And I want to get into kind of like the subsequent period of like the founding story of Altimeter. But before we do that, one thing that we like to discuss on this show is what I like to call cross-training. Like whether it be something that is an intended path or serendipitous, the kind of path that, you know, executives follow that kind of prime different skill sets throughout their career. And you know, I'll also interject a point there that, you know, as an analyst, I've noticed there are all kinds of analysts that come from all kinds of different backgrounds. Some come from industry, some come from, you know, kind of consulting and practitioner backgrounds. For me, I came as a journalist, which I always felt is a good kind of transferable skill set over to being an analyst. What does that mix look like for you? And not just as an analyst, but all the hats you wear in terms of a founder and you know, a book author and all that good stuff.
I think there are two areas of cross-training that really helped. First of all, I'm a business person, first and foremost.
Yeah.
I came out of college, went straight into management consulting, so I'm sort of bred from that strategic point of view, and it's definitely one of my strengths, is being strategic. So I always look at business strategy, long-term thinking, and that has really helped me be an analyst because everything I do is looked at through the frame of business and organizations. And technology is just one of the lenses that I really specialize in, but it's much more around the future, and technology is just one of the lenses of that. The other one is just managing people and being a person who can execute and really focuses on working through other people. It's one thing to execute yourself as an individual. It's something completely different when you need to get a team of people aligned around a purpose and a mission and then to execute on it. It's no longer about you, it's all about them.
Absolutely.
So I've been a student of leadership, and then writing about and researching it and seeing great models of leaders has been an incredible thing to watch.
That's great. And I want to get into some of that kind of those leadership dynamics that you espouse in a bit. Another thing that I'll add that I believe that you possess and what separates kind of like a good analyst from someone that is, you know, purely, you know, a practitioner in different business context is the ability to communicate well, to write and to speak well. And, you know, the proof is there in your kind of rap sheet in terms of all the things you write in your books and your kind of accolades. But I think that's an additional one that I think is great. So what I want to do now is go one level deeper on Altimeter. One thing we like to do on this show, particularly for all of the kind of startup entrepreneurs or would-be entrepreneurs that are listeners, to talk about kind of the founding story. You were at Forrester, and you left to start Altimeter. So tell us a bit about what were some of the drivers, what were some of the founding principles, and what were some of the things perhaps that you thought were missing in the world of kind of larger and more established analyst firms.
And I do this with the fullest respect to places like Forrester.
Oh, of course.
I was really happy for 10 years.
Yep.
But I was there for almost 10 years. And I had taken on pretty much every single role you could imagine without going into just straight management. So I was a research director, various levels of analyst. And one of the biggest issues that I had with Forrester, which was really smart for their business model, which is to be really role-focused, focus on a particular role like interactive marketing or customer experience. And it makes a lot of sense for serving that particular client. But after I wrote my book, my first book, Groundswell, I realized I wanted to explore this whole space of disruption and the new technologies that were coming down the pipe. And anything that's new, I look at it this way. Disruption doesn't understand boundaries of departments and roles.
Well said. Yeah.
So why limit yourself to that? And so the idea of going back and writing only for the interactive marketer felt really limiting. And I wanted to explore this broader range and think much more holistically about the challenges that we're facing organizations. Mm-hmm. So I left to found Altimeter, and it was that we wanted to take a very design thinking approach to the problems. And instead of saying, well, how does this impact a role or a technology, what are the underlying problems? And design thinking says you spend a good chunk, a third of your time, of your processing time, just trying to figure out what the right question is. Because if you're answering the wrong question, it doesn't get you to the right place. So Altimeter, we continue to do this. We look at things in a really different way because we're not bound by technologies or by industries or by role. Mm-hmm. And so we have the freedom to address some of the pressing questions that are out there.
And you're right. And for the sake of our audience, a lot of firms, most analyst firms, are absolutely segmented and siloed in that way in terms of analyst coverage areas. You know, it's almost like reporters that have a beat. You know, you cover mobile or you cover social or you cover whatever the area may be. And that is limiting in a lot of ways in terms of getting a nice holistic view of the universe. So that's very interesting that you kind of broke down those barriers in terms of the way that you engineered Altimeter as a firm. Now, another thing that we like to talk about, and we're fortunate to have you for all these great lessons, is not only kind of interesting founding stories and the drivers for them, but also in cases where there is a successful exit, some of the learnings from that. So you not only founded Altimeter, but a few years later sold it to Profit, where you still are and you still add a lot of value. But through that journey, what were some of the learnings that you have to pass on to our listeners in terms of, you know, growing the company, getting it to a point of being an attractive acquisition target for a company like Profit, the exit itself, the acquisition process, and also, you know, sometimes the challenges that a lot of companies see in integrating cultures post-acquisition. And I realize that's a lot of questions, but you can jump on whatever ones you think.
Yeah, there are two points. Let me talk about the real value that Altimeter created. Because of our research approach, we also had a different, very different business model. Almost every other established analyst firm has a subscription model, mm-hmm. where you subscribe, you get one seat, and you get access to all the research. We decided on something we called open research, where all the research was available to you for the wonderful price of free. So we gave it all away.
Nice.
And we made it back through the consulting and the thought leadership. And the reason I did this is because we didn't have the scale necessary to have a whole bank of thousands of analysts the way Gartner and Forrester does. Mm-hmm. We had four analysts. And so giving it away did two things. It just made it easy for us to build our brand. And we were writing about social. We used social. We used digital to increase our brand. And just after 1 year, we had the same level of brand awareness as the top firms, Forrester, Gartner, IDC, especially around these new technologies, which is where we focused on because we knew the dirty little secret that analysts don't like to cover new things out of their comfort zone. So we went there. And in the middle of a recession, that's where everybody wanted to know was how do we use social, how do we use digital to reach our customers when we have no marketing budget? And we could answer that.
Yeah.
And so that was a wonderful combination, but it did one thing also in particular, it elevated our brand. And so the advice that I have for entrepreneurs is really resonate and invest in what your brand promises and then deliver and execute on that promise over and over and over again.
Yeah, that's great. And, you know, the published material as a loss leader to drive the kind of higher value, high touch work, I think is inspired. And that's also interestingly, classic content marketing, like years before that became a very popular form of marketing. So that's great. So we're actually going to pause there for a commercial break. When we come back, more from Charlene Lee. Hi, everyone. This is Mike Bullen, lead analyst with Street Fight, and I'd like to talk to you today about Street Fight in 2019. So we've got lots of good things cooking and lots of opportunities for you to get involved. So we're looking for guests on this podcast. We're looking for editorial contributions from thought leaders. We're looking for inspiring speakers at our events. And all of that really comes together in the rich mosaic that you've come to know as Street Fight's thought leadership in location-based media and advertising and commerce and innovation. And part of that formula are lots of opportunities to sponsor content and have your brand associated with that thought leadership. So stay tuned for lots more information and announcements for those rollouts and reach out to us if you have any questions or want your voice heard in that chorus of narratives, including this podcast and messages like this one. So you can email me at michael@streetfightmag.com for more, and we're looking forward to working with you in 2019. So we're back. My guest is Charlene Lee. So Charlene, before the break, we were talking about the acquisition of Altimeter by Profit. And one thing that is very rare that I think you embody is a startup founder who is then acquired and then, you know, stays for a very long period in a very dedicated way, you know, beyond any kind of earnout period and beyond just like it's evident that your heart's in it and you're very happy with the kind of combined new company, which is, as you know, just such a rare thing. So tell us about, you know, what's different, what's differentiated and what did you do differently?
Well, in 2015, we were actually not looking to be acquired. We were looking for a round of strategic financing. And Profit just came out of nowhere. We had talked to them earlier, like 5 years prior, but never went anywhere as a partnership. And they said, you know, we really like what you do. We think you're a great fit, your digital DNA, but we want to acquire you. And I'm like, oh, that's interesting. And I pulled up my little card that they had on there, like all my prerequisites, and there were two things on it. They had to understand the strategic fit into the organization. But more importantly, there had to be a culture fit. Mm. And the culture fit just ticked so many boxes in so many ways. And not in terms of like, do they use the technology, but do they have the same approach? Do they have a humanistic, do they have the same values? And that was, I think, a great thing to do because strategy changes, the environment changes, but culture changes very, very slowly. And so like any acquisition, man, that first year was just tough. It's just hard.
Sure.
Keeping my team engaged and involved. They're like, what are we doing here? Like, this makes no sense. And every time I would go to Profit, like, it's not working for this reason. And they will, well, let's make it work. And every time I've gone to them, they have said, let's try to make it work. It's never 100%, but hey, we can get to 80% of that.
Yeah.
And it works. Right. And there were always constraints, but I always get the sense, and the team gets the sense, that they're trying their best and they really are listening. So that when I talk to founders or people who are going through this process, I'm like, I know you're talking about the strategic fit, but do they get you? Are they interested in a dialogue? Will they come to the table and have a discussion with you? Do you believe that's going to continue through thick and thin? Then that's a really good place. So I have transitioned into a straight individual contributor role. I'm not running Altimeter anymore. They were perfectly comfortable with that. They understand that my needs are changing as an individual and as a leader, the places where I want to grow, where Altimeter wants to grow, and they're willing to work with every single one of us and have a dialogue. Happy, happy is what I can say.
Yeah, that's great. And I think that too often in that process, founders and even the acquiring company are you know, probably blinded by lots of other factors, including money and other things, where that cultural factor is underestimated. So I think that's a great reminder to all of us. So you mentioned you're a contributor now, as opposed to being in more of a management role. So with that and kind of shifting gears to kind of put your analyst hat on, what are you looking at now that you're kind of particularly excited about in terms of technology and media and business transformation? I know that you're now big on the idea of kind of fixing social media, and that's something, of course, you've been looking at for a long time, as you mentioned earlier, and as you know, groundswell, I think, kind of established. So what are some of those areas that you're really kind of sinking your teeth into now as a thought leader?
Well, let's just take the area of social, because I've been looking at it for so long.
Right.
I'm finishing up a report on it right now, and social media has this terrible rap of being this dysfunctional place where radical ideas really take root and algorithms don't work and privacy is being violated. All of those things are true. But on top of that, the even worse news is that when you look back 10 years ago, there was this promise that social would make organizations more human and authentic and transparent. And it's just another promotional and marketing engine today. So where has that promise gone wrong? What can we actually salvage this? And I think there are ways, and I'm looking more at how organizations can use social effectively, and to some extent also how Facebook, YouTube, and all the various people can help make that more feasible too as well. Mm-hmm. The biggest issue, I think, is that we treat it like another marketing channel instead of a relationship channel. Mm-hmm. Marketing, in terms of being a one-way channel, we just send out messages versus really sitting down saying, how can we move a relationship forward? And I think it comes back to most organizations aren't interested in a relationship. They just want a transaction. So it's I've always said that social is like the canary in the coal mine. It's a great indicator of the health of the organization overall, mm-hmm. of how well it uses social. Because if you do think of your customers as people who you want to have a relationship with, you will run towards social, not just as a department, but as an executive, as customer service, even throughout the entire organization, you will just want to embrace it.
Yeah. And let's talk a little bit more about those kind of organizational dynamics, but moving on from kind of the technology's impact to the kind of the science and the dynamics of leadership, which is something you mentioned earlier. And you like to kind of sometimes talk or write about that aha moment. And this is something that could probably be the topic of its own podcast. But what are some of the kind of the dynamics of that in terms of in your writings or in your kind of direct dealings with executives, helping them kind of draw out that aha moment? And are there any kind of common barriers you see that kind of prevent it in the organization?
Yeah, I love the aha moment. It's what I strive for. It's that moment when people, this moment of clarity comes into their face, into their eyes, and they see the world in a really different way. And what I have found to be the most positive way to reinforce that, not from a fear-based way, but from a positive way, mm-hmm. is to connect them back to their customers. What do you want your customers to think and feel? What do you want them to say about you? And how would they describe that relationship? And even just going through that really simple exercise provides aha moments. And it's aha as in like, I have absolutely no freaking idea what they would say. And I better get my act together and go find some and talk to them. What do they say about us? To hearing, we literally look up on social media what their customers are saying right there and then. They go, I never knew that. I never knew they loved us in this area, or they can't stand us in this area. And it goes back to, I think, one of the biggest ways that we can fix how social is being used as in the organization is to turn it from social monitoring, where we're just looking for problems to solve from a customer service or opportunities to sell people more things, to really social listening, listening to what people are saying, how they're feeling, and use that as an indication how strong that relationship is. I think social can act as the conscience of an organization to make us sit up, stand up straight, and be responsible and responsive and proactive about what kind of relationship we really want with each other.
Yeah, that listening, I think, is great advice. And, you know, it would seem that the aha moment sometimes would be blocked by just being stuck in our own heads. So what you mentioned about, you know, being more self-aware through asking the question of, you know, what customers want or whatever that question may be, might seem to kind of shake those cobwebs. So that makes a lot of sense. That relates probably in some way to the book that you just finished, The Disruption Mindset, which will be out next month. So tell us a little bit about the thesis of the book, some of the high-level takeaways.
Sure. I've been writing and thinking about disruption. I'd like to say that my purpose in life is to help leaders and organizations thrive with disruption. And then a few years ago, somebody called me on this. So how do you actually do this?
Right.
And I went, well, actually, I don't know. So when I don't know the answer to a really interesting question, that's when I start doing research. And I wanted to find the antithesis of the blockbusters and the Kodaks and the Radio Shacks that are out there. Everybody knows those failures
right.
against disruption. Where are the successes? So I wrote a book chock full of these examples, but also try to figure out, like, what is that magic sauce that lets them do this? And it's not the usual suspects of Google and Uber and Airbnb. It's traditional companies like T-Mobile or McKinsey or Nokia. So, and the key thing, it's a really simple idea, is that they are all focused on a future customer. And that focus on the future allows them to make the sacrifices and make the investments today, those really hard decisions to invest for that future.
Yeah. And what do you see as the biggest challenges? Is it the quarterly earnings cycle that forces companies to look towards the next quarter, or perhaps, you know, the cannibalization concerns? You know, you mentioned newspapers. You probably saw this lesson very, very early on in terms of a failure to adapt or pivot. So what are some of the biggest challenges that are standing in their way of enacting some of those thought processes?
You know, I opened the book with an introduction about the newspapers and my experience at Knight Ridder. They absolutely knew about this challenge.
Yeah.
And they did all the right things. They did the Clay Christensen started business separate. I mean, they did all the right things. Absolutely. But when it came down to making the tough decisions to really invest fully into this space, the publisher said no.
Yeah.
They go, our business is in print. They could not emotionally, they could not financially take that last final step to fully, fully commit to a new strategy for that future customer. And that's how they lost it.
Yeah.
So there is a sense of quarterly things, but I think in the end, people want this to be easy, and it's not. That's why I go full force against disruption is really hard, and you have to prepare your strategy. You have to change your leadership. You lead in a really different way when it comes to disruption. And you also have to prepare your culture to be able to thrive with all of this change, thrive with what I call flux and disruption. And so you have to be very intentional, like, this is our path forward. It is not going to be easy. And frankly, it's not going to be for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But if you believe in this journey, then come join us. It's going to be a very interesting ride.
Yeah, it's interesting. One example I've always liked, I'm not sure if it's in your book, is Netflix early on and Reed Hastings looking at the, you know, the chart, and it's pretty evident that with broadband speeds and lots of other macro trends, that streaming would be their primary business, but that required walking away from the, you know, larger share of revenues they were currently experiencing with their kind of DVD business. And it probably required some hard decisions and short-term losses to get to that point of, you know, where they needed to be. So I've always kind of admired companies and executives that can do that.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is, I talk about that, but also the misstep that they took because of that whole pricing fiasco, right?
Yes, and Quipster, when they tried that rebrand, yes.
It was horrible. Right. They went back and forth. But they also knew that because they were protecting the red envelope revenues and separating it into the streaming, that they were being somewhat protective. So they didn't go full force and burn the boats.
You're right.
So, but the example I do give in the book is Adobe, when they went from packaged software to cloud-based software for the creative suite. And they knew, because of the way revenues are recognized, that their revenues and income would go down for 2 years or 24 months. And they were a publicly traded company. And they had to go to Wall Street. And they're not a darling or anything. They're a traditional enterprise tech company. And so the CFO, he was telling me, I went to Wall Street. And I told them, I have great news for you. Our earnings are going to go down for 2 years, and it's going to be fantastic.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what they did. And you'll never see, I had the chart in the book. The revenues go down, the income tanks, and the entire time their stock price is going up.
Yeah.
And it's because they were able to explain what the strategy was to go after this future customer, that they were painting a picture that this customer existed. They had some research on it. But, you know, did that customer actually exist? Could you go and find them and interview them? No. But over time, you could see that it was absolutely transitioning. And every time a customer stopped buying a pack of software and started subscribing, their income would get lower, but their future prospects would get higher, and therefore their stock price went up.
Yeah, and the beauty of that Adobe story is not just the long-term vision and the guts to take a short-term hit, but the ability to communicate that vision to Wall Street. So I think that's a key point. So we're actually going to pause there for another commercial break. When we come back, more from Charlene Lee. Hi, everyone. This is Mike Bolin, lead analyst with Street Fight, and I'd like to talk to you today about Street Fight in 2019. So we've got lots of good things cooking and lots of opportunities for you to get involved. So we're looking for guests on this podcast. We're looking for editorial contributions from thought leaders. We're looking for inspiring speakers at our events. And all of that really comes together in the rich mosaic that you've come to know as Street Fight's thought leadership in location-based media and advertising and commerce and innovation. And part of that formula are lots of opportunities to sponsor content and have your brand associated with that thought leadership. So stay tuned for lots more information and announcements for those rollouts, and reach out to us if you have any questions or want your voice heard in that chorus of narratives, including this podcast and messages like this one. So you can email me at michael@streetfightmag.com for more, and we're looking forward to working with you in 2019. So we're back. My guest is Charlene Lee. So Charlene, before the break, we were talking about all of the kind of the lessons of disruption and communications and lots of other great findings from your upcoming book. We're going to go into our lightning round next. But before we do that, how can interested listeners find out more about your book? Or I believe they could even pre-order on your website. What would be the best way for them to do that?
They should come to my website, charlenelee.com. charlenelee.com, and it's all there.
Great. Excellent. I'm definitely going to pre-order a copy myself. So let's go right into our lightning round. So first off, Charlene, what's something about you that few people know about?
That I like to jump off of high places.
Nice.
The higher, the better, the faster the acceleration. I just love that thrill of right before you're jumping off a high place. Your palms are, by thinking about it right now, my palms are kind of sweating. There's excitement to it. I feel so alive at that one particular point, and it's an awesome feeling.
Yeah, wow, we've never gotten that answer. I like that. What's the profession you'd want to have if you weren't doing what you do now?
I'd be a professor. I'd love to teach.
Ah, that makes sense. Yeah, I like that. What's a company or tech startup, could be historical or or current that you think it would be most exciting to be part of at early stages or the moment of inception, like Woz and Jobs meeting at the Homebrew Computer Club or, you know, the HP Garage or even something more modern?
Actually, we'd go all the way back to Henry Ford starting Ford Motor Company.
Yeah.
Just the innovation and the sheer audacity. And it was so competitive. There were like 100 different car companies, and what he did to just stand out and accelerate past them. Been fun to watch that.
Yeah, that's the ultimate disruption. I like that answer. What's your favorite tech product or app that you use as a consumer?
I use an email company product, which I invested in for full disclosure, called Superhuman. Mm-hmm. So I pay the privilege of $30 a month to use email, but I can actually get to zero inbox. I'm kind of disappointed there's no more email to process. Is that kind of weird? But man, it has totally changed my life.
Yeah.
It makes me happy to use it.
I've been hearing a lot about that product, and I think it exudes one kind of not always winning success factor, but one that we've seen a lot throughout kind of tech history, is taking something that people do already that is kind of a core utility and reducing friction from it. I mean, that's Uber, that's several other examples. And I think that Superhuman, just theoretically in reading about it, not using it yet, seems to kind of tick that box.
Yeah. You know, someone always asked me, and I know there are a lot of entrepreneurs listening to this podcast too, what are the best opportunities out there? And I'm like, look, just follow a working parent, especially a working mom, around for a day. And just make a list of all the problems that she has. You solve any of those problems, you will be a billionaire.
Yeah. Wow. That's great advice. So who's someone from the business world, alive or dead, that you admire most and why?
I love Katharine Graham, who was the CEO of Washington Post. Mm-hmm. There's a great movie, The Post, about her too recently. Just being a woman at a time when the expectations were so low, and she just crafted a path forward for what women leadership could look like. And again, I really admire some of the pioneers who led that way before and continue to do that. But she was there for so long and led in so many different ways and really rose up to something that she had never thought she was capable of doing.
That's great. I just wrote that down as for my wife and I's like viewing list. We're always kind of looking for, you know, what to watch next Friday night at any given time. So that's now on the list. Thank you.
Great.
What superpower hero would you most want to have?
Oh, this is an easy one. I would fly.
Nice. Well, that seems to align with your first answer about being exactly, in high places. Right?
Exactly. Then I wouldn't have to climb. Like, the hard part about jumping off of high places is that you have to usually climb up to them.
Yeah.
So I can just fly up and I can just swoop all the time and get that acceleration.
Very cool. So what are some passions or hobbies that help you mentally unplug from work?
I make slow foods like artisan sourdough bread or kombucha. Trying my hand at other fermented foods like kimchi and stuff like that. But I love making bread because you have to like stop and you are at the mercy of the yeast, rising or not rising. And it's not really cooking or baking. It's a science experiment.
Yeah.
Every single time you make the bread. So I'm fascinated by it.
Yeah. More science than art. I love that. So lastly, what are some of your personal goals for the remainder of 2019?
I think one of the major side projects I have is to start a network called Quantum Networks, which is a global network of these disruptors who are trying and striving to create disruption in their organizations, in their communities, and in their society. Disruption is a really lonely job. You feel like the only person who's sane in your organization sometimes. And so I want to be able to support these disruptors in this network to create circles where they can really put their messy on the table, so to speak, and just, if nothing else, get inspiration from other people going through the same journey. Because I feel like there's so much change that needs to happen in this world. So let's get as many of these change makers together so that they can inspire and support each other.
Yeah, that's awesome. Sounds like part support group, part networking, and part knowledge building. That I could definitely see a big need for that. So that's actually all the time we have. So I want to thank you, Charlene, for spending time with us.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you all for listening. Stay tuned for future episodes of Heard on the Street. You can find us on streetfightmag.com. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts. Also, stay tuned for lots more writings and multimedia from Street Fight. So this has been Heard on the Street. I'm Mike Boland. Thanks for listening.